Did you think you were God, Brandon?
You don't love me. I'm just something you caught. You think I'm some kind of animal you've trapped.
That's right, you are.
Did you ever try to keep warm on a C-54 at 15,000 feet, 20 degrees below zero?
Oh, I do it all the time.
It's not good to find out too much, Charlie.
But we're sort of like twins, don't you see? We have to know.
Oh, we have 12 vacancies. 12 cabins, 12 vacancies.
Not that I mind a slight case of abduction now and then, but I have tickets for the theater this evening. And I get, well, kind of unreasonable about things like that.
Well, it's a cinch. Here, I look up, I look down. I look up, I look down.
You know, I've got a theory that you should do everything before you die.
Alfred Hitchcock expressed himself through a refined and unique visual language, which he often referred to as pure cinema, or filmed emotion. The director's predilection for storyboarding is no secret. As such, the contribution made towards his films through the storyboarding process cannot be overlooked or underestimated. In this episode, I spoke with filmmaker, multi-award-winning writer, and Hitchcock expert, Tony Lee Morrell, who's written a new book all about Alfred Hitchcock storyboards. We explore the role of storyboarding, the inspirational team of artists who helped bring these films to life, and the musicality of Hitchcock. We also discuss the architecture of space, the importance of colour and mood, and the influence and impact of storyboarding to this day, diving into the storyboarding process and celebrating the people who worked with and around Hitchcock was such a delight. So, without further ado, I invite you to enjoy my interview with Tony Lee Morrell on Alfred Hitchcock Storyboards. Welcome back to Talkin' Hitchcock, and today I'm delighted to be sitting down for post-film drinks in my screening room with filmmaker, multi-award-winning writer, and Hitchcock expert, Tony Lee Morrell. Tony has also penned The Making of Hitchcock's The Birds, Hitchcock and the Making of Marnie, and the Young Alfred Hitchcock's Movie Making Masterclass. But today we're here to celebrate and discuss his latest work, Alfred Hitchcock Storyboards. Tony, welcome to Talkin' Hitchcock and congratulations.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you very much for inviting me on the podcast.
Thank you. And I've been following Tony's work ever since I discovered his book on Marnie. I'll just do a jump so Tony can see that on the shelf.
Oh, I see. Brilliant. I didn't see that. Brilliant.
It's sitting with Robin Woods and Tanya Modleski, so it is in very good company.
Definitely.
So we're here to talk about your latest book, and I've got many questions for you. However, before we get into that, I'd love to hear from you, Tony, about your first experience with Hitchcock, and perhaps if you can tell us a little bit about your journey with his work and what it means to you.
Sure. Well, my first Hitchcock film was I Confess. I was about 11 or 12 years old, and I didn't really know much about Alfred Hitchcock. I did know the name because I'd read the Three Investigators books, because anyone as a child has heard of Alfred Hitchcock and the Three Investigators. So I was an avid fan of those books. And all I knew that Hitchcock was this very large, charismatic English gentleman who was driven around in a Rolls Royce, according to the book. So that was my image of Alfred Hitchcock. So I first saw a Hitchcock film, I Confess, and I was just immediately struck, even at the age of 11 or 12, by the moral ambiguity, the kind of conflicted emotions that a Montgomery Clift has gone through. And I was raised a Catholic myself, so I understood about Catholic guilt and moral ambiguity and going to confession. And so the whole idea of going to confession and having a secret being told that you can't divulge, I mean, for people who don't know the plot of I Confess, Montgomery Clift plays a priest in Quebec, and he is actually in confession, and the murderer confesses a murder to him. But because of the Catholic rites of duty and passage, he can't divulge. And then he becomes the suspect in the murder. So it's classic Hitchcock ingredients of a wrongfully accused man as well.
I confess, I think that's the first time we've had that on the podcast for a guest's first film. It's normally people say Psycho, Rear Window, North by Northwest, just to begin with. And what a simple conceit that film is, but how beautiful that ambiguity, like you say.
I think so. I think I'd have been a bit traumatic if I saw The Birds or Psycho at the age of 11. I wouldn't mind watching Rear Window or North by Northwest, but I'm glad I started with I Confess because it was an entry, obviously, into Hitchcock, which was very similar to my own upbringing at the time because Catholicism was a big part of my childhood.
Okay, so Tony, you've written several other Hitchcock books that we mentioned earlier, but how did the inception then of this project come about, and how was it to put this book together? What was the contrast there in terms of the process and the composition?
Well, Titan is a publisher very much admired, and I actually approached them 25 years ago, to begin with,
Wow.
in about 98 or 99 on the Marnie book. But they weren't really interested in the whole book on a single subject, and I can see why, because Marnie was a bit academic for them. So Titan was always in the back of my mind. I've always admired their books. Whenever I go into Waterstones or Blackwell's, and you go to the film section, and you see books on James Bond or Blade Runner. And so I love their visual presentation. And no one had done that on Hitchcock. And because I was in with the Hitchcock estate, they basically gave me carte blanche to republish, because this was my fourth book on the storyboards and artwork. And obviously, I'd known the artwork for The Birds and Marnie on, very well from the Margaret Herrick Library in LA. But no one had done a real concise dive in, looking at the whole kind of over of Hitchcock's career. And I couldn't do every single film because the library wouldn't want me to publish everything in their files. I've got to keep some secrets. But so I just took a selection of films, 9 or 10, from his early British period to Torn Curtain and Family Plot. And that seemed a right way to do it. Films which I hadn't really investigated in detail, especially Shadow of a Doubt and Spellbound, and take them chapter by chapter through the stages in Hitchcock's career from early British to late Hollywood.
Yeah, and that's one of the things that I enjoyed so much about this book is that it does take you through those stages. So you get this sense of, Hitchcock's entire filmography and just how instrumental that storyboarding process is. So one of the things I wanted to ask about is how were these storyboards preserved? How have they been kept and stored over time?
They're preserved very carefully at the Margaret Herrick Library in LA, which is part of the Academy of Motion Pictures, Arts and Sciences. But they're also at the Harry Ransom Center at the University of Texas at Austin, because Ernie Lehman and some other screenwriters, and David, most importantly, the David O. Selznick files are kept at the Harry Ransom Center. So a combination of those two locations. And you have to order them off site. They're kept in beautiful folders. You have to wear white gloves to pick them up. And, they are treated like the sacred manuscripts they are, I think, because this is film history. So you have to make an appointment, have them ordered off site, go in with your white gloves and look through the folders. And it's an absolute treat to do that.
I bet. And so this book as well, it's such a beautiful book and it's so wonderfully presented. It's so carefully thought out. And I love how visual it is and how that seems to me to be in dialogue with Hitchcock as a filmmaker, as well as someone who communicated to the visual. How you've mentioned there about Titan and having that love for the layout of their books, but how did you go about arranging the layout and the design of the book?
I chose the storyboards and I wrote the captions, but it was really the wonderful art director and art design production designer of the book who needs to take credit for it. I remember the early stages, they sent me some color schemes and they designed them on the posters, the original posters of the book. And so if you think of Psycho, it was blue and yellow, The Birds was green, Marnie was red. So they based the color scheme on the original posters, like Vertigo behind you. Vertigo is very much associated with the color orange. And so I thought that was a neat way to do it because it was brand recognition that a lot of readers would be familiar with from the posters.
And there's a moment in the biography section as well where you mention that beginning in silent films, Hitchcock had a tendency to rely on the camera to tell his stories visually. And I wondered how far you might agree that it's really due to Hitchcock's career beginning in silent films that he becomes that visual filmmaker and focuses on that. You know, we've spoke a lot here about, you know, pure cinema and Hitchcock's thoughts on that and his commitment to that. But do you think that was instrumental in who he was as a filmmaker, and that had he been born later on, maybe like post-talkies, we would have seen a different filmmaker emerge?
I think so, because his very first job in the movie industry was designing title cards for Famous Players Lasky, which was an American company, and they hired him. Previously, he'd worked for a telegraphic company. So, architecture, design, doodling, sketching was very much part of a young Alfred Hitchcock. And all his collaborators would say he would spend a lot of time sketching and doodling when you had. Talking about setups of a camera. So he always used to say, you know, what's in the rectangle is very important. And what is beyond the rectangle, whether it's like the set, the stage, isn't as important. It's what the audience sees. So he was always talking about that square that he had to film, and that's where his love of camera logic came from.
Yeah, is that, I think that's the quote you open the book with, isn't it? Isn't it on the sort of
Yes.
the introductory page? Such a fantastic quote.
Yeah.
And so the main chapters here are devoted to films that are featured in the sound era. But I wondered if you undertook any research into storyboarding in the silent period of Hitchcock's work.
I didn't delve too much into that because, as I said, I started with the 39 steps, but similar processes, set design, costume, mise-en-scène, German expressionism was hugely important because he went to Germany in the mid-1920s and he learned from the masters by watching Fritz Lang or Murnau, as he was saying. And so the use of light and shade, distorted images, shadows, that kind of impressionistic scene, which is, you know, in all his work right up until Marnie, very much an expressionistic film. And so Hitchcock was very influenced by his German upbringing in the film industry, and he would work again with Oskar Werndorf, who came over from Germany to do the set designs for the 39 steps, and the storyboards are in the book, which actually held at the British Film Institute here in London.
Oh, fantastic. And so I'm sure we don't want to reveal too many secrets within the book because we want people to read it and we want people to enjoy the experience of discovering all those the wonderful things that you reveal and those beautiful designs that are in there. But can you share with us one of your favorite discoveries, perhaps, across your research? Did you uncover anything unexpected?
Well, I found the 39 step storyboards, which I had not seen before because they were catalogued differently. So I'm pretty sure they haven't been published because when you go on the internet and you see the book, see the storyboards for the 39 steps, there are six key sequences which come up again and again. But the ones which we found, I've never seen before. So I'd like to say they're newly published.
Wow, what a treat. What a treat for you, and what a treat for people that pick up a copy of this book to be able to see those storyboards for the first time. It's incredible. So I want to talk a bit about the actual storyboards, and then can you tell us, Tony, in the most simple of terms, what is a storyboard? What's its function and purpose in the filmmaking process?
So, a storyboard is a depiction of what appears on the screen, whether it's an action. It also denotes camera placement or camera movement, what figures are in the shot, what costume. It might even suggest the background, the architecture, the props. So it's a visual means to convey to the production team what's intended to be filmed. And I try to keep it more relevant today because obviously not everyone's going to make a Hitchcock movie, but with the proliferation of technology, TikTokers, Instagrammers, people who do reels, storyboarding can be useful to them if they're planning out their short film or reel. And so we can learn from Hitchcock. And the 39 Steps is particularly relevant because it's filmed like a succession of mini stories or as scenes upon themselves, as Hitchcock described them, little films within a film. And so it's very episodic in its structure, which is one of the reasons I love the 39 Steps. And I think it'll be great for today's storytellers to look at it and look at how Hitchcock storyboarded and brought it together.
And so Hitchcock repeated his use of storyboarding throughout his career. How much do you think this is about creativity, and how much is it about as well, like these two things in tandem, perhaps more than against each other, about him maintaining some element of control? Is there a sense of, in working from these storyboards, that this means that what is being shot matches what's on the page? And does that make what shot the only thing that can make it to the final cut, so to speak?
Yes, his primary reason for storyboards was communication, as Robert Boyle told me, to the art director, to the cinematographer, to the wardrobe. And so it was a blueprint. And Hitchcock was obviously famed for having everything on paper, script on paper, storyboards on paper. And so he was very keen to portray that in his thoroughness and preparation. Of course, they would deviate it, but it's that comfort level, especially with your script, you know, because and he was very cost conscious, and he rarely went over budget, and so that's why the studio liked him, and he was very prepared, and he knew what he wanted and how it was shot, and storyboarding was very much a part of that.
And so we know how close Hitchcock kept these storyboards during the filming process. Would he have used these directly as a guide when shooting?
Yes, it's but certainly in something like The Birds, which relied very much on special effects, on composites, on live birds, on model birds. So they were very carefully storyboarded. And spoke to Harold Mikeson. He said he went to join them in Bodega Bay, and that was how important a storyboard artist was, because you know not many films will take their storyboard artist on location, but Hitchcock knew how important Harold's work was. And so invited him. And talking to Joseph Mosso, and I know you picked up on that quote as well, you know, he liked to have an illustrator in his pocket. And so Joseph Mosso was working at the Universal Studios as a young artist for Torn Curtain in 1965. And he said Hitchcock would come and look over his shoulder and comment. And he was very much kept on until the end of production and was actually doing storyboarding during the filming of Torn Curtain as well.
Yeah, I do love that quote, the illustrator in the pocket. It just demonstrates how key the storyboarding process is, and how close Hitchcock likes to keep those people in part of that process and collaboration. But reviewing some of these storyboards, I'm reminded because I've seen some of these examples already in your books, Tony. But I'm reminded of how precisely the boards match the finished picture. It's just extraordinary. And yet, there's something so heightened and poetic about Hitchcock's work that seems to cut against this idea of extensive planning and organization. I wondered, like, what your thoughts are on the balance between these two forces.
I think it was a case of taking the storyboards and working with his cinematographer, whether it was Robert Burks or Jack. And so, for example, something like Juanita's death in Topaz, that was storyboarded to some extent, talking to Karen Dorr, the actress. But it is an extrapolation of ideas, sharing of ideas, taking the ideas, whether it's the visual camera movements in Notorious or Marnie, and just taking it one step further. And so Hitchcock wasn't rigid and say, this is the way we're going to shoot it, but was very obviously open to collaboration with his cinematographer and his production designer. And another example is during the filming of the Arbogast murder in Psycho. I mean, he asked Saul Bass to storyboard it. I think Saul did a very kind of tense, tight montage. Then Hitchcock looked at it and said, why don't we do just a sweeping camera movement up the stairs? And so it doesn't seem like there's a hint of menace. You know, there's a menace because we know the story, we see the door become ajar. So that was one instance where they actually deviated from the original storyboards. But again, Hitchcock worked very closely with Saul Bass on the sketching of a shower sequence and pretty much followed it to the letter in some ways when you look at the storyboards and then you look at the original film.
And you make mention as well of the effect of storyboarding in Psycho being like an orchestral symphony, which Hitch often spoke about, didn't he? How far do you think then that like Hitchcock was thinking musically through his planning and through these storyboarding processes? I get certainly a strong sense that he's thinking rhythmically in terms of highs and lows.
Definitely. He saw it as a roller coaster ride. He'd always say, I want to put the audience through it. He was a complete Svengali with the audience, saying, I really want to manipulate their emotions. Maybe some time he just wanted to have a button where he could push and like make people laugh or make people scream. And so that motif, the orchestra, was very much part of his cinematic language.
And I'm so delighted that in your book you devote a chapter to Marnie, one of my absolute favourites, and the first Hitchcock film I really got obsessed with. And
Yeah, you're not the only one.
I'm glad.
We should definitely do a podcast just on
At the
Marnie.
time, in my early 20s, I thought I was literally the only person in the world that had
No.
this obsession. Yeah, what pulls me so deep into Marnie is Hitchcock's attention to what I identified with something that you mentioned in your chapter, which was a remark by Robert Boyle about Hitch being interested in feelings. And to me, Marnie's just one of the strongest and most emotionally powerful examples of, you know, what Hitchcock himself would often say, filmed emotion. And while storyboards are largely thought to be about planning, we've talked about organization and the technical aspects of filmmaking. In what way, I'm curious to hear from you, what way do you feel that Hitchcock utilize these storyboards to convey feeling and emotion in his characters? And maybe if you could specifically talk about Marnie, that would be great.
Sure. Well, he storyboarded the opening sequence of Marnie. As Robin Wood says, no one needs to look more than the opening sequence of Marnie to show what an auteur Hitchcock was in terms of conveying feelings through the camera to the audience. So it starts with a tracking shot on Marnie's handbag, and then it pulls back to reveal Marnie walking along a deserted platform. And so that was storyboarded. I've seen the storyboards in the archives. It's not in the book because I concentrated on the hunt sequence, and also the racetrack storyboards are in my Marnie book. And so Hitchcock was very much storyboarding Marnie to convey feelings, the isolation of the central character, the psychological isolation, and how her world is kind of, she's very much alienated from the world around her. When you think of that opening image of her walking along a deserted platform. And so that corridor motif is established throughout the film, and Marnie's very much on a journey, whether it's riding on her horse Forio or traveling in trains or taxis. As Robin Wood says, Marnie's always traveling, but doesn't seem to be getting anywhere. And then that famous shot at the end of the film when Mark and Marnie drive off into the distance, past a fake backdrop of a ship. And so again, Marnie's on a journey. But there's hopefully a hope at the end of the tunnel. So Hitchcock really thought of all of that very much, and it's in the taped interviews between Hitchcock and Hedren in the Academy of Motion Pictures, Arts and Sciences, when they go through the entire film in detail, and whether There's a famous shot after they get married and they're at the door of Wickwin, and Marnie's face is to a camera, and only she can see the troubled look, and that's in the transcript. The troubled look returns. And so Hitchcock wanted to convey that feeling of trouble and alienation and being kind of a victim of patriarchal society to free Marnie to the audience, and so all of that was carefully storyboarded.
Hello, listeners. I would just like to take a brief pause from my interview with Tony Lee Morrell to tell you a little bit more about the Vintage Video podcast. Patrick, Jesse, and Richard are a trio of film lovers who've decided to rewatch and review every major film release from the 1980s in chronological order. So they've got their work cut out there. You can listen along as they analyse all the films we love and spoil everything that you haven't seen. So cheer them on through this decade, and the 80s happens to be my decade too, so I'll be listening for sure. And because they can say it a lot better than I can, I'm going to play you a brief trailer so you can hear more about the Vintage Video podcast.
On the Vintage Video Podcast, we'll be reviewing every single wide release of the 1980s in chronological order. Over 250 episodes to enjoy and thousands more to come. John enters the store now to order another can of ether. I picture him outside like Homer with the gasohol.
One for you, one for me.
I also like to think about that the kids renew their vow not to talk about the murder.
By murdering someone.
They're taking a blood oath with someone else's blood.
This stuff is 7 times more powerful than uranium. And they open up the vault that it's contained in, not wearing any kind of protective gear. Yeah.
And it's wooden crates.
Wooden crates. It's like the guys in Chernobyl picking up the graphite rocks and going, nah, because there's rocks.
Hugging the elephant foot. Just like, oh, this thing's smooth.
It's so warm.
He turns to dial the number from the classified ad without even thinking about the numbers. We know this because we can hear his thoughts, and he's talking about how AJ was right that ninjas are misdirecting him.
They're misdirecting him.
I really wish that he'd turn to the phone and been like, six, six. That's too fast. Vintage Video. We're rewatching the 80s so you don't have to.
And it was very interesting as well to read more on Tourniquet, and you've alluded to it already, but it's a film that to me doesn't seem to receive enough attention. And in particular, Joseph Musso, who worked in the art department, and Hein Heckroth as well in production design. But there's a section within that where you speak about the shift in the colour and how that is a shift in mood as well. Yeah. And that puts me in mind of the 56 version of The Man Who Knew Too Much and the shift there from Marrakesh to London. And just in consideration of that, I wanted to ask, would colour and mood be something that was indicated in the storyboarding process as well?
It was very much talked about in production design. And so speaking to Rita Riggs, the costume designer for Psycho, Birds and Marnie, and Helen Colvig on Psycho, production designer like Robert Boyle, colour was very much part of a discussion. I've never seen any colour storyboards because that they didn't tend to work in that way. There are some beautiful watercolours of Mandalay and some of the other kind of production sketches. We've got the sketches of the birds in there, which are in colour. They're different from storyboards. They're more like watercolour production artwork, and similarly for North by Northwest. And so Hitchcock certainly communicated with those kind of production designs rather than the typical black and white charcoal, which was more used for the action sequences. So if you look at The Birds, that's very much a colour film as well. And so you've got Melanie in cool green, You've got flashes of red, especially with Annie Hayworth wearing a red jumper or the red post office box. And the house, the Brenner house, becomes very much a character in The Birds. And so we've got a production artwork in the book where the architecture of the house becomes very important, especially towards the end of the film.
And house is just so important in Hitchcock's work, corrupting the safe space always.
Yeah.
But I want to talk about the people now, because storyboarding encompasses so many elements. And that's one of the things that I really learned from this book, is just a storyboarder is not somebody who just simply draws on paper or works with paints. I mean, there's so much more to it. And this book's a real celebration of those people around Hitchcock, you know, the team who supported him and brought his vision to life, as much as it is about him and his work. So I wanted to just briefly cover a few of the key figures that you mentioned, beginning with none other than Miss Dorothy Holt, whose name I came across and was so fascinated by her. She's one of few female storyboard artists working at the time. And she became friends early on, as I understand it, with Robert Boyle, another important person in the Hitchcock cabaret, if you like. And I learned that she was involved in a great number of pictures with Hitchcock, actually. I think it was 7. How did her paths cross with Hitchcock then? And what was their work and relationship like?
They first met through David O. Selznick, because we all know the story. David O. Selznick brought Hitchcock to America to work on Rebecca. And she was working for Selznick as a storyboard artist. She said, you know, she sketched that damn Tara staircase about 67 times for Gone with the Wind. And so she was from LA. She was very interested in props and set design. And she was a strong woman, because she was the only person working in Selznick's art department was a female. And the men were very perturbed when she started. And I had wonderful interviews with her children, because Dorothea passed away, I think, about 2010. Would have loved to interview her, but her children were wonderful. And I also spoke to a lady who'd interviewed and worked with Dorothea called Peg McLennan, who gave me some great memories. But she had a great sense of humour. So when she arrived in the Selznick art department, to appease the men, she put up a barrier and threw some stockings over the barrier, saying, I am a woman and this is my territory, which is wonderful. So I'm sure Hitchcock loved that. Yeah, and I think Lynn, her daughter, told me that Hitchcock would have enjoyed that sense of humour as well, being such a strong woman in a male-dominated industry at the time. And as you say, she was probably one of the very few, if not the pioneer storyboard artists. And she came from an architectural background herself, because that's where she met Robert Boyle. They were studying in California, along with Henry Bumstead, the production designer of Vertigo. And so she went on to work on Shadow of a Doubt, which I delve into in a chapter in the book. And her knowledge of period architecture and antiques was very important, as her son told me. So she would research in libraries, and she would, like, if you look at Shadow of a Doubt, Hitchcock was very keen to convey a typical American family in 1941 or 42. And so it's a classic American house. I've actually driven down that road when I went to Santa Rosa. I just made an effort to go and look at that house in McDonald Avenue, I think it is. And so it's in a typical suburb just outside of the city centre, a very typical American house. And that was the beauty of Hitchcock, the genius. You wouldn't think that evil would be lurking underneath that surface in films like Blue Velvet or Shadow of a Doubt. And so he was very interested in what would happen if you put an Uncle Charlie figure, and then chaos erupts within that nuclear family.
Yeah, avoid the outside stairs, as advice. But yeah, you mentioned the Henry Bumstead, and I'd like to just mention him as well. He worked in art direction for Vertigo, as you mentioned, and he came as well, I think, via a recommendation from Robert Boyle, and he began working on The Man Who Knew Too Much, and it was fantastic to read about how he sourced things like rugs and mosaics, and again, all those things that I just don't think a storyboarder, you know, someone in art direction would be doing, and he'd scout locations as well. But there's a quote in that chapter about him being one of the director's favourite people. So I wanted to ask, what do you know of their relationship, and why was that such a good partnership between them, do you think?
Yeah, I spoke to his son, Bob, because obviously Henry's passed away now. And so Bob gave me some great memories. I think it was just a mutual respect that he knew that Henry Bumstead knew what he was doing. Again, he was a fine architect and a sketcher. He could draw, you know, a horse's anatomy just right off the bat at the age of 7 years old. So that artistic talent, that natural talent would have been something Hitchcock recognized and appreciated. And I think also the kind of shared interests, whether it's wine or cigars. And Hitchcock actually asked him to design the library in his Santa Cruz home because he loved the Gavin Elster set design, the office in Vertigo, so much. If you think about it, it's a shipping magnate with the oak woods and the panels and the model of a ship. It's very luxurious, speaks of old San Francisco, speaks of old money. So Hitchcock asked Henry, who was very good at designing for character. So I write about that in depth. So whether it's Scotty's apartment in Vertigo or Gavin Elster's apartment in office in Vertigo, he'd very much provide the set and the look, which character, how characters would inhabit it. Mm-hmm. And he's very keen about how you age a set. So a creaky doorknob on a wooden handle, for example. He didn't want anything that looked like it. The set decorators had just come in and furnished a set. And so even if things are off camera as well, because there was a stamp collector set in the James Stewart apartment, but I can't see it. But it's there. I'm sure it's on there on the desk. And he would think, you know, because he learned that you have to dress the set for character. He once put too many books in a set. And I think it was Hans Dreyer, the Paramount head at the time, said, is your character a learned man? And if not, why does he have so many books in your set? So it's that kind of thinking, which I think Hitchcock appreciated as well.
And Robert Boyle as well, we've most mentioned, he worked with Hitchcock on several films. And, yeah, you know, he's someone who identifies as well with characters in the script, that being really central to his process.
Yes.
Do you think that was part of why Hitchcock and Boyle worked repeatedly together?
Yes, and we had so much mutual respect and love for each other, I'm sure. I had the pleasure of interviewing Robert Boyle many times in 99 and 2000 before he died for the Marnie book. So yes, he just respected that Hitchcock was a consummate filmmaker, and their career started, association started very early with a Saboteur in 1942. And there's that anecdote of them sketching, and they heard that Pearl Harbor had happened, you know, which was terrible in December 1941, but they were so dedicated to their work, we just went back on with the sketching. And so it was that kind of mutual camaraderie and love of filmmaking, love of art, which they shared.
Amenta Hubner, his story and career was really striking to me as well, because he'd begun working in Disney on Snow White and Seven Dwarfs, and at just 19 he lost his right eye, you know, during following a cancer diagnosis. And you know, there's a quote from him that I really liked where he speaks about when he's drawing, he is directing films on paper, which I really loved, and it speaks to just how deeply he's thinking about the process. And his first film was with Hitchcock was Strangers on a Train, and you noted in the book how few storyboards survive of that film. I wondered, did you get to see any of those at all? Or
I haven't investigated Strangers. There may be the odd one or two, but the trouble is, as we all know, a lot of these storyboards were discarded. They weren't considered valuable. No one would be thinking in 50 years' time we'll be treating Hitchcock's films like Monet's and Matisse's, you know, just sacred works of art. And so I asked Robert Boyle, do you have anything more? He said, no, I was so stupid, I threw it all away. And so we're lucky we have what we have, but they are few, and I'm sure there are masses more treasures which were to be found, but unfortunately they were discarded. And even there's that great story in the book on Spellbound about the Salvador Dali paintings which were found. So that was fantastic.
Yeah, we will leave that as a treat for readers. But yeah, that was what a story that is. But yeah, Harold Mitchelson as well is someone I wanted to briefly mention. He storyboarded for Rear Window and The Man Who Knew Too Much and comes back to work again on The Birds. And his watercolours is just why I wanted to mention him specifically, of Lydia and Mitch and the Brenner House are just beautiful. This film is like Shadow of a Doubt, one in which horror takes place in broad daylight, which I love. And, you know, we've got the school building and the cafe around which those key scenes take place. What do you think about the use of space in the film and how that reflects the interiority of the characters?
Is this The Birds?
The Birds, yeah.
Hitchcock was very keen on the architecture of space in The Birds because it's all framed as if we're in gilded cages, as and Mitch Brenner says to Melanie at the beginning, get back in your cage, Melanie Daniels, your gilded cage. So the architecture of a Brenner's house was something that Robert Boyle and Hitchcock would very much investigate. And they found the Rose Gaffney house on the outskirts of Bodega, which was perfect because it's kind of isolated with a pier. And then the whole architecture of the film, like the telephone box sequence, the Tides restaurant, and then the Brenner house and the attic attack. It's people being locked in their cages and the birds kind of taking over. And so there's that very famous shot, which Robin Wood talks about, where Melanie is receding against a couch or the wall and the birds are just attacking. It's very psychological, the way he framed it. And Hitchcock said in the pre-production, well, she's like crawling back, or she's reacting to nothingness there. So it's very much psychological, the birds, rather than an actual exterior threat, which is very interesting. You can see that with Melanie. And so Hitchcock was very keen to show that through the storyboards and the architecture of space.
Yeah, and space is something that I wanted to come on to, actually, because Hitchcock is sometimes spoken of as someone who focuses less on characters' backgrounds, shall we say. But there is a wonderful quote that I think you may have mentioned earlier from Henry Bumstead about, you know, what he learns from Hitch is that he carries out the main theme of making sets look like people that live there. And he liked to see what people would do in that room, which I love. And it's interesting to me because that, to me, cuts against the idea of Hitch not being interested in character. And so the attention to character in their settings is evidently so important in Hitchcock, wouldn't you agree?
I do agree. I mean, the kind of character, the motif, very much so the importance of character and setting, because Hitchcock wanted to convey, he wanted to avoid the cliche a lot. And so a very famous example is North by Northwest, when Cary Grant is dropped off at the Prairie Stop in Kansas and there's nothing there. And Hitchcock said the cliche way of attacking a man would be a dark alley, shadows, a cat, a villain with a moustache. But with North by Northwest, he drops in up in openness and there doesn't seem to be any threat at all. There's the red herring of a bus coming and then the man gets on before echoing that very sinister line. That's funny. There's a crop duster dusting crops where there ain't no crops. And so when the bus goes, you know something's very strange going to happen. And then the plane starts to attack Cary Grant. And so Hitchcock very carefully thought about character in relation to location. And he wanted to use locations to the maximum, whether it's in the Albert Hall, in The Man Who Knew Too Much. He's especially interested in famous landmarks or the Statue of Liberty in Saboteur. And so the classic example, as we said, was North by Northwest or in Mount Rushmore. He wanted to convey that feeling of the prestige of the American presidents. He wasn't actually allowed to film on Mount Rushmore after the National Park Service saw the script and said, well, why doesn't Hitchcock go to England and have a grant bag on his nose? So they were kind of perturbed by that. So they had to build that enormous Mount Rushmore set, which Robert Boyle did.
So your book's a close look at designs, illustrations and matte paintings and how these contribute to the set and the finished picture. And I recently had a mailbag episode of the podcast where people were invited to ask anything. And one of the questions I was asked about the effect of reality and fantasy upon the viewer through the blend of Hitchcock using real locations and studio sets. And I wanted to extend this question to you because for me, one of the distinctive qualities of Hitchcock's work, what draws me to it, is how he takes the real world and combines it with the fantasy world, something heightened, to create then a Hitchcockian world all of his own. So I wondered what you thought about Hitchcock's use of blends and real locations with studio sets and how that affects the audience.
We delve into a lot in the Marnie book and the birds and somewhat in the storyboards book because Hitchcock was primarily a studio-based filmmaker. He loved the studio. He loved process. He's very concerned about the lighting. He didn't like the vagaries of the weather, even up to Family Plot. He didn't want to get out of his limousine when he was filming in San Francisco. So he wasn't an action-oriented outdoors director. He'd often give second unit stuff to people like Tom Wright for the runaway car and Family Plot. I mean, Marnie is an obvious one with its rear projection, horse riding sequence, and I go into detail a lot in the storyboards for The Hunt. But I think because Hitchcock was such a lover of cinema, a lover of new technology, he would, as Hilton Green, who was a production unit manager on Psycho, told me, he would have loved the technology we have today, or the CGI, he would embrace it. They didn't have that technology in the 1960s. And so that's why some films were like Marnie could be seen as antiquated. And it was a time when VistaVision and Lawrence Arabia was filming on location. You have a gorgeous widescreen. And the Tom Jones Hunt as well, the Deer Hunt, had been filmed, which I talk about in the book. And so that impacted on the Marnie Hunt a lot, the way that was eventually shot and edited. I don't have any objections to what Hitchcock did because he was very much, as we were talking about, a psychological filmmaker, very interested in feeling. So if you get the feeling of emotion, you get the feeling of alienation. Obviously, I can see why it's difficult for modern day audiences when they look at the painted ship in Marnie and just laugh, or they look at the studio sequences of a back projection and see it so artificial. But as Robin Wood makes a very persuasive case, it was part of Hitchcock's filmmaking technique right back from the Lodger, that impressionistic, as we spoke about the German expressionism, which was he was very keen on.
So looking ahead then at the future and the influence of storyboarding in terms of the role of the storyboard artist, the designers, the illustrators, how long did you discover these positions remain generally within the industry? And do you know anything about how those roles have taken shape today?
Speaking to artists like mentor Huebner's daughter and Tom Wright, they did carry on in within the Universal because they had art departments, and obviously that was carried on into the 80s, especially with George Lucas Spielberg film, especially towards action sequences. And mentor Huebner worked on Blade Runner, which was his big film apart from the Hitchcocks. So it did carry on. Then it developed into what's called pre-visualization, which uses CGI as part of a storyboarding technique. And so it's very much inherent today. And I know that today's directors, whether it's Christopher Nolan or if it's Martin Scorsese, are very much influenced by Hitchcock's storyboarding and artwork. So it's very prevalent, I think.
And there's a quote from, you've already mentioned it, but there's a quote from Marnie's unit manager, Hilton Green, talking about how Hitchcock loved matte shots because it gave him more control and because he took some kind of pleasure in making an audience question how shots were achieved. But he also goes on, as you pointed out before, Tony, to say that Hitchcock would have really relished the use of CGI. So do you think that Hitchcock would have embraced new film technology? And in what ways do you think he might have enjoyed making use of that?
I think he definitely enjoyed it. As I said, he was in Universal in the 70s when Steven Spielberg was coming in as a bright new protege and, you know, was stealing his thunder with films like Jaws and Close Encounters of the Third Kind. So he was very aware of it. He was aware of the technology. But sadly, he was just suffering from ill health and decline. And so, but if he had been a bright young man in his 40s, he would have embraced it and he would have taken over and used it for those artificial worlds. And he probably used it for location filming, which he didn't enjoy. And yes, it's sad that we never got to see his work without technology today, I think.
We'd all be following him on TikTok, wouldn't we?
Yeah.
So in your conclusion then, you give some space to Topaz and Family Plot, two of his last films. So what this illustrates to me is Hitchcock is really right up until the final moments of his career, remaining devoted to this storyboarding process,
yeah.
You know, and he brings that vision into the world, as you say, also his own, like his own hopes and fears. And I wondered to what degree you might consider that Hitchcock is also using the storyboard process as a means of working through some of his own desires and apprehensions in a controlled way. Is he filling that rectangle with some of his own, you know, personal like demons and preoccupations as well?
Well, he was certainly interested in the unusual and the not everyday, as Jay Preston Allen told me. And so a classic example is a murder in Torn Curtain, which we talk about in the book. And we all know it's very difficult to kill a person, as Hitchcock said, not just like, bang, you're dead. And so the farmhouse sequence was storyboarded in terms of props. And again, that's a great example of using character with location. And so you use all the accoutrements of what's found in the kitchen, like a knife, a shovel, and finally the gas oven. And so, yes, Hitchcock would use the storyboarding for his own interests and demons. He was fascinated, as we all know, in the macabre and things that weren't usual. Whether it was a rape scene in Marnie, which was storyboarded in terms of camera, he wanted the camera on her face, and then that phallic image of a porthole, which the camera pans to something like the murder in Torn Curtain, and even a beautiful shot, which I really like, is the overhead shot in Family Plot, the cemetery shot, where you've got Bruce Dern and Kathleen Nesbitt almost like chess pieces. And that's a metaphor for the structure of the film. So he's very interested in the structure, as he said, two couples finally meeting together, but have kind of parallel but interchangeable stories.
So I think we've had a pretty in-depth discussion here today, but what's next for you, Tony? I hope I'm not speaking out of turn here, but I hear rumblings that you're working on another book about Hitchcock. Can you tell us any more about that?
Yes, I can. There's been a lot over the last 10 years about Hitchcock's reputation, as we all know. So I've actually been writing it for the last 10 years, more than that, 12 years now. And certain people have made stands against Hitchcock. And I can't say too much yet because I'm still shopping for a publisher, but I think it's going to overturn critical thinking on Hitchcock, because there are a lot of information I couldn't publish at the time on the Birds of Marnie in particular. And so it won't be like a complete autobiography, like a Patrick McGilligan book or a John Russell Taylor book, but I'm hoping it'll fill in some of the blanks and hopefully change people's conception of Hitchcock, which I think has been very unfairly maligned in the last few years.
We are into Rebecca Recommends. Usually I would use this space to recommend an outside resource or some paper that we've discussed or author. But today, all I want to do is recommend Tony's terrific book, Alfred Hitchcock Storyboards. If you're a Hitchcock fan, a cinephile, someone with an interest in film history or production, this book belongs on your shelf. I recently reviewed it for Dread Central, but I will post that review in the show notes so you can take a look at that. And I will make sure as well to include the purchase link as well so listeners can find that. But thank you so much to Tony, my wonderful guest. It's been an absolute delight to talk to you. I'm wishing you all the best with the book. Where can people find you online then? And where can they pick up this book?
Just my name on Instagram, on Twitter, Facebook, Tony Lee Morrell. But also on Amazon, or you can go to a Titan Books website in the US, it's Penguin Random House. And so and just shop around for deals. I think Forbidden Planet's doing a good deal on it at the moment as well. So
terrific. Well, thanks for joining me today. It's time to leave the bar of my screening room. We are about to close, but don't fret. You can find Talkin' Hitchcock on Twitter at @Hitch_pod and Instagram at @TalkinHitchPod. So if you like what you hear, please consider support the podcast and giving us a follow. What are your thoughts then on my conversation with Tony and Alfred Hitchcock storyboards? If there's anything you'd like to share, you can reach me on talkinhitchpod@gmail.com. I've been your host, Rebecca. You can find me in my work, including my series of essays on Hitchcock's women with Moving Pictures Film Club on Twitter and Instagram at Pendle Pumpkin. Thank you so much for being here with me. I look forward to seeing you back in the screening room soon. But until next time, stay curious and keep talking Hitchcock.